BCFM Sports Saturday.
9 minutes past 3 o'clock.
It's been a close game. Chelsea look comfortable.
Bristol City have been very, very disappointed indeed. A very poor performance.
And here goes Calvin Williams with the Olympic torch.
Join Paul Davis and the team every Saturday from 3 p.m. on BCFM 93.2.
A 1,000 years after the death of Christ, money changers, those who loan out and manipulate the quantity of money, were active in medieval England. In fact, they were so active that acting together, they could manipulate the entire English economy. These were not bankers per se. The money changers generally were the goldsmiths. They were the first bankers because they started keeping other people's gold for safekeeping in their vaults. The first paper money was merely a receipt for gold left at the goldsmith. Paper money caught on because it was more convenient than carrying around a lot of heavy gold and silver coins. Eventually, goldsmiths noticed that only a small fraction of the depositors ever came in and demanded their gold at any one time. Goldsmiths started cheating on the system. They discovered that they could print more money than they had gold, and usually no one would be the wiser.
Then they could loan out this extra money and collect interest on it. This was the birth of fractional reserve banking. That is, loaning out many times more money than you have assets on deposit. So, if $1,000 in gold were deposited with them, they could loan out about $10,000 in paper money and draw interest payments on it, and no one would ever discover the deception.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We preview the Bilderberg Conference. In fact, we look at the technical aspects of it. Quantum computing, artificial intelligence, and the end of work at last week's Bilderberg Conference in Turin, Italy. Two of the freelance journalists covering that conference were Marco and Maria for We Are Change Rotterdam. We hear their views on the significance of the technology they're discussing behind closed doors, much of it developed under wraps by the US military. And the politicians who are there, like our own Amber Rudd, get a strong message as to who's really in charge. Yes, it's the tech giants, not the people. So what's this technology all about, and why is the 5G so-called smart grid being trialled here in Bristol and Sheffield before it's rolled out across the UK in the next couple of years? Why is 5G so crucial to this technological change? Will it bring in a utopia or a dystopia? And what are the health dangers? Why has nobody been asked whether we want this or not? Also, more atrocities in Yemen every week. We look at one powerful arm of the Israel lobby, the B'nai B'rith. Who are they and what's their real agenda? Who better to answer that question than the lawyer son of the American Jewish boycott lawyer, the Committee for Nazi Germany, Anton Chaikin, plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Our sister show Dialects back on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, we go to People's Republic of Stokes Croft and look at the Bear Pit particularly, but also a series of documentaries that they're putting on there. And also look at a meeting coming up at the Ark Bar in Broad Street about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Now, we start this week, though, Martin, by looking at the events over in Singapore about North Korea and also the possible implications for what's going on in the Middle East.
Well, as I said in the first hour, I'm guardedly optimistic about this. At least they're talking. That's better than...
Has Trump actually got anything out of this deal?
Well, what he's got out of it is it's softened his image slightly. So there are positive PR aspects to this for him.
But I mean, has he actually got anything? It looks to me as if the real winners are North Korea, because the Americans have now agreed not to have any exercises of invading North Korea.
Well, I mean,
what has Trump got out of it?
Well, what he's got out of it, as I say, is a slightly softening of his PR image. And, of course, they're still quite belligerent towards everybody else. So they're being nice to the North Koreans, but they're being horrible to everybody else. They're being horrible to the Iranians, they're being horrible to the Europeans, they're being horrible to the Chinese, they're being horrible to the Russians. So being nice to the North Koreans, who are not very popular anyway, doesn't really change very much in the big scheme of things.
So was it all just for the cameras?
Yes, basically, from Trump's point of view, it's essentially a PR. From Kim Jong-un's point of view, it's a life or death thing. And I think the real winners here are the South Koreans, because they've the Democratic Party in South Korea, which is the left-wing party in South Korea, have basically managed to finesse this into being. And they've played Trump very cleverly. The right wing in South Korea are going and gnashing their teeth because they don't want this cancellation of these exercises. But if you think about it, it's perfectly logical. These exercises basically are exercise practicing attacking North Korea. They're doing the same sort of thing in the Baltic states and in Eastern Europe and in relation to Russia.
Now,
if you carry on doing stuff like that, it's bound to put people on edge, isn't it?
Well, one of the best journalists on the planet, I think, fair to say, that is Robert Fisk. He's worked for The Times, now for The Independent. And why do we hear nothing of him on the BBC, even though he's one of the best and most, I suppose, authoritative analysts in the world?
Well, it's because, as you well know, the mainstream basically blackballs people who don't play by their rules, and he's somebody who's a genuinely independent.
I was listening on Irish radio once, and he said, well, it's because when the BBC phoned me up, they say, well, if we were to have you as an interviewee, what would you say about this? And he says, well, I'll tell you live what I'll say, but I'm not going to discuss it all beforehand. Mm. That does strike me as a little bit worrying, is if someone phones you up to do an interview and then says they want to know first what you're going to say. So then they may decline the interview, depending on your point of view.
Well, they ought to be able to work it out from reading his stuff. The fact of the matter is that the BBC is to some extent controlled by the government and very much terrified of the Israeli lobby.
I mean,
Fisk is going to be somebody who's going to say things that are going to annoy those people.
Resigned from the Times not long after Rupert Murdoch took it over. Something very strange has happened to British journalism when one of the greatest journalists in the world, who happens to be British, is not seen or heard on the BBC.
Well, that's because the mainstream is a dream factory for the masses. It's not there to tell them what they're not supposed to be thinking about.
Well, let's have a listen now to Robert Fisk being interviewed by Jeff Blankfort from a radio station in California about Trump.
Yes. You said I resigned from the Times in opposition to Rupert Murdoch's purchase of the paper. That is not true. Rupert Murdoch had purchased the paper many years before. I resigned from the Times because they declined to publish a front-page story, which they originally wanted to, saying that an Iranian Airbus had been shot down over the Gulf, this is in 1988, by an American warship because the American captain had panicked. They preferred to run an editorial saying that the pilot of the Iranian passenger plane was a suicide pilot, which wasn't true. And inquiry by the U.S. did prove indeed that the American warship crew had been panicking as they fired at the passenger aircraft. As a result of that, the Times did not carry my story, which was true, although Irish papers did, and I resigned from the Times and joined the Independent. It was nothing to do with Murdoch himself, though, of course, his influence was very obviously over the paper.
Well, thank you for clarifying that and recalling that story. The USS Vincennes shot down the Iranian passenger plane. It's a story we don't hear about, and thanks for bringing it up. You know, Tuesday's 11 in Singapore with Kim Jong-un has been grabbing the headlines and monopolizing our airwaves. And I've been feeling this may be a sideshow to make Americans less aware of what's happening in the Middle East, which you've been writing about with regard to Iran and Syria. What's your take on that?
Well, it's interesting you put it that way, because a very dear colleague of mine made the point yesterday while watching this nonsense on television that this might be about Iran. This might be a way of being able to push the American line that Iran is the, you know, the dangerous nuclear power by showing that, in fact, it's possible to defang, as the Americans like to say, North Korea's nuclear powers. It's interesting that the man who is prepared to talk to a tyrant who has nuclear weapons, not just is wants to develop them, but who's got nuclear weapons, and who carries out atrocious human rights abuses, that Trump should be prepared to talk to him, but to actually tear up an agreement which has prevented Iran from manufacturing nuclear weapons, and of course having no interest at all in talking to the Iranians.
Well, I think that's probably right. I mean, I think there's been an executive decision at the top in the US that they're probably only going to go to war with Iran to help keep the Israelis happy. And if you're going to do that, you've just got to put the North Korean thing on ice.
But what about this utter hypocrisy when it comes to Iran and Israel, where you've got Israel committing horrific human rights, racist human rights abuses, a form of genocide, what with the attack on Gaza a few years ago by artillery and by aircraft, and more recently Israeli soldiers shooting dead 130 or so peaceful protesters and wounding over 5,000 people, including killing medics, killing journalists. I mean, that's a human rights abusing regime with nuclear weapons that's Trump's friend, and yet he's torn up this agreement with Iran. I mean, this seems to be absolutely ridiculous and not being, I mean, it really is, it's an object of ridicule, surely. We would, if we had spitting image on, this would be on there on the telly, or Rory Bremner or whatever on the TV as a satirical program, just literally making fun of Trump for this utter hypocrisy. And yet he's ripping up a deal which has supposedly stopped the Iranians even thinking about developing nuclear weapons. Obviously they're thinking about it, but doing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, all along, it's not been about Iran's nuclear weapons. It's about the regime itself. Anything the Iranians did to keep the Americans happy is obviously a waste of time, because ultimately the Israelis and the Israeli lobby in the US want the regime in Iran removed. And as you mentioned there, the Israelis have got hundreds of nuclear weapons completely illegally. And in actual fact, under the law, I think, I can't remember the name of the act in the US, those who proliferate nuclear weapons, all aid and trade should automatically be cut off from them. And that's why the Israelis won't admit in public that they've got these nuclear weapons, because there's legislation in the US which would immediately bring sanctions to bear on them. And of course there's been no sanctions on Israel. They've got US military embedded now inside Israel, and they receive massive subsidies. They receive the lion's share of the US foreign aid budget, even though they're a first world country. And that money doesn't go to the Palestinians, it goes to the Israelis to pay for all sorts of military equipment, which of course they buy from the US military industrial complex. So the US taxpayer subsidizes their own military industrial complex via the Israelis, and of course they are very dangerous, and they want a war, and we should be talking about this, because the British have got to decide, do we want a war with Iran? Because I don't think we do, and if we don't, we need to speak up now.
What about this airliner that Robert Fisk was talking about right at the start there? In 1988, a US warship shot down an Iranian airliner and mistook it for an F-14 fighter. They killed 300 people. It was flying from Iran to Dubai.
Well, I mean, it was a horrific incident at the time, and of course the Americans tried to wriggle out of it and say that they didn't do it and it was all the Iranians' fault and so on.
Well, it was Iran Air Flight 655, and it was on the 3rd of July 1988. The USS Vincennes just shot it down in cold blood.
Yeah, well, what you had going on at the time there was the Iran-Iraq War.
A scheduled flight on normal flight plan?
Yeah, we had the Iran-Iraq War going on there, and if you remember, there was the tanker war going on, where the Iraqis, with support from the West, were attacking Iranian oil tankers, and then of course the Iranians were responding by attacking Iraqi oil tankers, but the Iraqi oil tankers were being protected by the US. And so all of these things have been going on for years, and you know, it's just incidents like this can easily escalate into all-out war. They haven't, because, you know, born by good luck and good management, they haven't. But the possibility is always there. And, of course, the US has also deliberately done things to make the Iranians unhappy. I think in this case it was probably accidental, but they've actually supported terrorists to go inside Iran and kill loads of people. The Israelis have assassinated loads of US Iranian nuclear scientists, for example, and boasted about it. If the Iranians were to do anything like that, everybody would be screaming terrorism, terrorism, terrorism. But then when they do it, it's just, well, you know, that's the sort of thing we do.
News in Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper this week, that Israel sold advanced weapons to Myanmar, that's Burma, during an anti-Rohingya ethnic cleansing campaign. Israeli-made Navy patrol boats, custom-fitted with remote weapon stations, are part of arms deals estimated to be worth tens of millions of dollars.
Well, I mean, they've got their own military-industrial complex in Israel now, developed with US resources. And, of course, the problem with the military-industrial complex is to make, you know, it's there to sell stuff. And the Israelis, you know, are quite happy to sell stuff. They've been very involved in Latin America, for example, supporting various unsavory regimes there over the years. I remember when I was in Colombia on a trade union delegation a few years ago, there was this Colombian army soldiers, you know, guarding this place. I was looking at the rifles. I don't recognise that rifle. What's that rifle? And I said to the local guys, you know, what's that rifle? I said, it's a Galil rifle, Israeli rifle. And of course, they've been very involved in, you know, supporting the military in Latin America, who've been very much torturing and killing their own people. And the Israelis have been very involved in that.
So the British also sell lots of arms to the Israelis, don't they? But, I mean, looking at the Israeli military, we've really got to ask questions. This ex-spy chief said the fun part about Mossad is that it's a crime organisation. But apparently Netanyahu is not amused. This is another article in Haaretz this week. Former Mossad chief Tamir Pardo has said it's a crime operation with a licence. So I suppose that's almost like the James Bond licence to kill kind of thing. Netanyahu has responded, Mossad is a glorious organisation.
Well, you pay your money and you take your choice. What's the truth? The truth is that it's a very dangerous and ruthless organisation which engages in terrorism and assassination and then wants a pat on the back for it. But of course, as we go into World War III, it might be that all of this belligerence is going to lead to consequences which those involved have not contemplated.
Netanyahu addressed the report, which was published last week, and accused him of asking the former head of the Shin Bet security service to listen to the telephone conversations of the then IDF chief. So this is the Prime Minister spying on the head of the army.
Well, historically, the army in Israel has tended to be less belligerent than the politicians. That's not always true, but, you know, and in actual fact, it's only a matter of degree. But, you know, in the past, one has looked to Israeli Defence Force figures to be a voice of moderation to some extent. But I'm afraid Israeli society as a whole is becoming more and more paranoid and psychopathic. And Netanyahu is very much, you know, feeding that and feeding off it. And the possibility of some stupid, reckless provocation is very much on the table.
I mean, this hatred of the Arabs and the Muslims, is it too much to draw comparisons with the racial hatred in Nazi Germany?
I think that they get offended when people use this kind of comparison, but it's a perfectly legitimate comparison. Yuri Avery, who's very good, he's an old guy now, he's very good, used to be a terrorist, used to kill British soldiers, but he's very much on the peace camp now. He says, well, you know, within Israeli politics, people accuse each other of being Nazis as, you know, it's just normal knockabout stuff. I don't think it makes much sense to compare different situations, but the Gaza situation, it looks very similar to something like the Warsaw Ghetto, for example. It's not a concentration camp, but it's not a holiday camp either, is it? Let's face it.
Situation gets worse, really, all the time, doesn't it, over there? It almost as if the international community gives Benjamin Netanyahu a pat on the back. Every atrocity that happens, the latest series of atrocities are the soldiers shooting the unarmed protesters at the Gaza border. It almost encourages him to do something more.
Well, that's right. I mean, and don't forget, he's himself under investigation for various frauds and malfeasances, and he's got a personal interest in directing everybody's attention to get, you know, he's managed to get Jerusalem recognised as the capital by Trump, and he's keen on a war with Iran. I mean, people shouldn't kid themselves. Netanyahu was here not long ago in Britain talking to Theresa May
last week,
and he will have been saying war with Iran, war with Iran, war with Iran. And of course, we're not told this. The media, you know, the media in this country don't really talk about it that much, because it's actually, they know that it's about as popular as Ebola.
I mean,
they do have demos
over in Israel which aren't reported here quite a lot, actually, where people come out on the streets and protest against their government, but also, of course, pro the racists. So in the Israeli towns this week, residents have taken to the streets in their hundreds to protest the sale of a house to Arabs. The racism of ethnic superiority has become a legitimate reality under this right-wing government, says Bethan McCann at The Independent yesterday. The deputy mayor of the northern Israeli town of Afula has joined a demonstration calling for a house in the community not to be sold to undesirable Arabs.
Well, the other thing that's happened is that there was a motion in the Knesset that all citizens of Israel should be equal. That is to say that Jewish and non-Jewish residents of Israel should have equal rights. And it was struck down, I believe, by the Supreme Court, because any Jew from anywhere in the world, from Argentina, from America, from Britain, can go to Israel and immediately become a citizen, whereas Palestinian families who've lived in the place in the region for generations live in refugee camps in places like Jordan and Lebanon, and they can't leave the refugee camps because they've got no documentation. They're stateless people, and this is simply outrageous, and it's been going on for years. And of course, the Israelis have got away with all of this because the rest of the world basically turned a blind eye. But ultimately, when you've got war breaking out, you know, the attempts to partition Syria and so on and so forth, the existence of states as they are now is not necessarily going to carry on. And I think if we go to World War III, two states which are most likely to be eliminated by the end of that war will be Saudi Arabia and Israel, because neither of them have a legitimate basis to exist.
What about boycotts? Because that's one way that people can, I suppose, from, you know, if the government won't intervene, and we'll be hearing a bit more about that in a minute, a British government in a situation like this and making its views felt about racism and genocide, then by boycotting Israeli goods, that's one way you can do something. Do you think that's ethically acceptable?
Well, I think it is ethically acceptable. Of course, the model for this is what was done with the South Africans, where when the big municipalities in the US, Chicago, New York, etc., withdrew their municipal funds from investing in South Africa, that's when they crumbled. But in actual fact, what's happened as a result of that is that laws have been passed in the US and elsewhere that say that anybody even suggesting boycott of Israel should lose, that, you know, that they will be punished for suggesting it. And therefore, the whole strategy of boycott, which I'm totally in favour of, has been undermined by changes in the law to make it difficult for people to carry out boycotts. And that's because the Israelis have lobbied to make sure that that's the case.
One of the supermarkets in Britain that carries Israeli goods is Waitrose. And I spoke to campaigner Esther Giles earlier on, just the end of last week, about this very subject, and she's saying that some of the dates that you can buy in Waitrose, she's been writing to Waitrose asking them to stop stocking them, but they keep deleting her comments that she makes on the Waitrose website, and they're refusing now to reply to her emails.
The Palestine Solidarity Campaign has been working for a number of years and identifying supermarkets to sell produce that come from Israel. So I decided to have a little look in my local supermarket, Waitrose in Westbury-on-Trim, to see whether there were any Israeli products on their shelves.
Now, well, anyone can do this, can't they, for any supermarket?
Have a little look. And if you go in, you can usually see, well, usually or always, the country of origin is listed. If you look carefully at the labels. So I knew that I should look for things like medjool dates, because many, many medjool dates come from Israel, and in particular from the occupied territories, some oranges, some other citrusy type fruits. So I went to have a little look at the labels. I also had a little look online at the Waitrose online store to see what I could spot that had come from Israel. And so I've identified a number of products which I know definitely or probably come from Israel. Now, I address this in a number of ways. So first of all, on the customer product reviews, on dates, I posted a comment that actually I'm really shocked that Waitrose is stocking products like Medjool dates from Israel, but they wouldn't actually post the comment. They said it breached their guidelines.
Well, hang on a minute. That's just a fact, isn't it?
Yes, yes. But obviously I wasn't surveying the quality of the product. I was making a political point, and they said that they don't get engaged in political discussion.
Okay.
So the other thing I did was to write to them separately from that to make a number of points to them about the occupation, about the aggressive settlement tactics of the government, and wouldn't it be reasonable for Waitrose, being an ethically oriented company, to stand for the human rights of the Palestinians and refuse to stock Israeli products? The other thing I did is I went into the store and personally made a complaint to customer services, pointing out the specific products I'd identified on the store. I got the same comments from everybody. And in fact, when I complained in the shop, I was literally shaking with anger because I was so shocked that they're selling this stuff. And I went up onto the customer services desks and said, I am angry. What they did is they recorded my complaint and said they would forward it to customer services, which they did. But I have heard nothing back. I've encouraged friends and colleagues to write to Waitrose and other supermarkets and suggest the sorts of products they need to be looking for. But you're right, Tony, it needs to be coordinated a little bit better than one person randomly writing
okay.
to Waitrose.
Dates, oranges, what else should we be checking the origin of?
Passion fruit, pomegranates, Sharon fruits. Now, there are two, interestingly, there are two manufacturers of products that are no longer stocked in Waitrose that used to be. So Carmel was a manufacturer based in Israel that Waitrose used to stock. I did a Google on it. And when you look at the online shop, it says this product is no longer stocked. So I think if people are going to be really careful about this, they need to look at own labels, because I think what may be happening, as with Medjool dates, is that rather stocking the stuff from the producer that's named an Israeli producer, they're producing them under their own name, with Israel as a source of origin of the product.
Esther Giles there talking about her specific efforts to get Waitrose to actually even pay attention to the fact that even though they're supposed to have an ethical policy, that there is a genocide going on over in Israel. Do you think there's going to be any sort of campaign comparable to the South African boycotts in the 1980s, Martin?
I think that's definitely on the cards, and the Israelis definitely fear it. And that's why they're trying to push this idea that anybody who calls for a boycott of Israel is therefore ipso facto an anti-Semite, which is frankly absurd and insulting.
Also, there's a report on a website I'd not come across before, but it's called Amity Underground. Motion to the British Parliament to condemn the slaughter of Palestinian civilians receives fewer signatures than the motion to cherish British hedgehogs in the same week. Early day motion to condemn the slaughter of 63 Palestinian civilians at the hands of the British equipped Israeli Defence Force received only 28 signatures in the House of Commons, three fewer than a motion to cherish hedgehogs by regulating various traps taken 2 days before. Not a single member of the incumbent Conservative Party signed the motion. Only 18 of 257 Labour parliamentarians signed it, though Eastgate Easington MP Graham Morris sponsored the bill. The Green Party's only MP, Caroline Lucas, signed it, with the rest of the signatures representing Scottish National Party, Plaid Cymru and Liberal Democrat reps. I mean, this doesn't show a great deal of interest by... it's almost like the British MPs aren't really interested in what's going on in
Gaza. Well, I think it's quite significant that no Conservatives signed it, but I think it's quite shocking that only 18 Labour MPs signed it, and I would suggest that Thangam Debonair, who's a very solid majority in Bristol West, where she is now, and actually went to the anti-Semitism protest against Jeremy Corbyn, she might think it's in her own interest to sign such a motion, even if it doesn't come to be voted on, because when the next election comes, she's going to be facing the Greens in this constituency, and it'll be one of the Greens' top targets. And one of the things they're going to say is, why didn't you sign that motion?
There is also, when we'll be discussing it further next week on Dialect at noon on Tuesday here on BCFM, but there is actually a discussion for anyone that's interested in this topic from all directions about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia at the Ark Bar in Broad Street at 7 o'clock on Monday the 25th of June. Speakers are from Palestinian human rights lawyer. There's Jewish Voice for Labour there, one anti-racist activist, Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Stop the War Coalition, and the National Union of Teachers, Martin, all getting together to discuss this.
Yeah, and it's been sponsored by a variety of different organisations. I spoke to somebody about this earlier in the week, and it looks like it's going to be quite a lively discussion. I'm very glad to see that Jewish Voices for Labour are going to be there. We need to hear the voice of progressive Jewry. We're not anti-Semites. We know that that there's plenty of Jews out there who think like we do. They don't like people being oppressed. And one of the Jewish socialist groups' slogans is, always on the side of the oppressed. Always.
The English Defence League founder Tommy Robinson had a big demonstration the other week in London, Martin, about this. But the thing is,
not about this.
About Tommy Robinson being arrested.
Yeah.
But the topic of Islamophobia came up in a lot of speeches there. Why is it that the rights groups like the EDL are so, it seems, affiliated with the Zionists now? You actually see Zionist flags at quite a lot of these right-wing events.
Well, that's what's been happening, is that the right wing everywhere have some shared interests. And you feel like saying to Tommy, do you remember when the Israelis used to kill British soldiers? Do you remember, Tommy? The King David Hotel. It wasn't mostly British soldiers, mostly Arab civilians working with the British government. Are you a terrorist, Tommy?
What do you make of the arrest then and the imprisonment of Tommy Robinson?
Well, I've followed it to some extent. I mean, basically, he was arrested for contempt of court because it's a trial in Leeds, which is trying to send some people down for grooming young girls. Many of these people on trial are Muslims, or they're not practicing Muslims, I don't suppose, but they are of Muslim origin. And he's then latched onto this as isn't this terrible? These Muslims doing all this stuff. Now, in actual fact, the police have arrested them and put them on trial. And what Tommy's doing by turning up and shooting his mouth of outside the court, he's leading to a situation where the trial might collapse because the defence lawyers are going to argue we're not getting a fair trial here because Tommy Robinson's sticking his finger in. So the judge then says to Tommy Robinson, you've got to stop doing this. Tommy pleaded guilty. He's not called Tommy, actually. He's called something else. Yaxley Lennon. And, of course, he doesn't use that name because he used to be a BNP activist, British National Party activist. He wants to pretend to be something other than he is. And, of course, the court said, we don't want you sticking your finger in here because we're trying to send these people down, and it's quite possible by you shooting your mouth off that they might get off. And of course that's why he's been sent to prison, because he's been making a nuisance of himself. And of course I also think that he's possibly both the English Defence League and Al-Majid Haroon were born at exactly the same moment in Luton, and that's where he's from. And I believe that personally that Al-Majid Haroon and the English Defence League are heavily infiltrated by MI5. They're basically Gladio style organisations.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that there's a strategy of tension being run in this country. Jihadis are basically like the Islamic Fighting Group based in Manchester. They're based in Manchester because MI6 invited them to Manchester in the 1980s.
I noticed, by the way, a lot of activity on social media really promoting Tommy Robinson and promoting the idea that he's been unjustly put in jail, and it's really an issue of freedom of speech, but it's not, is it?
No, it's not. It's contempt of court. He's running the risk. I mean, Geert Wilders came to speak at this rally last Saturday, and he got support from the French National Front. If you look at photographs, you'll see various people marching around giving Nazi salutes. And these people are Nazis by any definition.
Okay, so there's a piece in the Guardian.
What do we do with Nazis? I don't know.
There's a piece in the Guardian.
Talk to them? Shoot them?
Piece in the Guardian yesterday. This by Claude Moraes. The far right is organised and growing. Those Nazi salutes are serious, he says. Tommy Robinson's supporters are drawing strength from racist movements in Europe and the persistent popularity of Donald Trump. About 15,000 supporters of Tommy Robinson, the former leader of the English Defence League, marched in London last week. Some were aggressive, attacked the police and physically threatened anti-racists who were peacefully protesting against them. Among their number were people raising their arms in Nazi salutes. This is a serious situation that demands attention from everyone who wants to combat the racist politics that have regrettably emerged from so many parts of Europe. Now, exactly the same happened, Martin, didn't it, in the 1930s, in the rise of Nazi Germany, largely because of poverty. This was looking at someone to, down the road or nearby, also poor, probably, to blame for the economic woes. So when a country is in a difficult economic situation, it's actually fertile ground for this kind of thing.
Yeah, well, okay, well, let's just... what I'm also saying is there is a strategy of tension happening in Britain. And the original strategy of tension in Italy, the intelligence services were running far-left, far-right organisations. They were running both sides of the park. And I think that's exactly what's going on here. The English Defence League and Al-Nadja Haroon, supposedly chalk and cheese, they both emerged in Luton simultaneously. The Royal Anglian Regiment marched through Luton, having come back from Afghanistan, and Al-Nadja Haroon protested against the Royal Anglian Regiment, and then the English Defence League came to the defence of the Royal Anglian Regiment and its business in Afghanistan. And of course, we've got no business being in Afghanistan, and of course this whole thing is on the back of 9/11 and all the rest of it. But I believe that all of these groups, the jihadi groups that were told to fear, and the English Defence League, are heavily infiltrated by the intelligence services.
But I mean, is this sort of modern equivalent of the Oswald Mosley black shirts?
Yes, it is. But the intelligence services were active in that era, but not as active as they are now. Don't forget that the whole Islamist jihadi setup was part of Operation Cyclone, in which Britain was the lead agency in the 1980s, and that's where we brought all these jihadis to Britain. So that's where they came from, Tommy.
And
MI6.
Are the idea that these are going to be kind of street fighters in the future, a bit like the SA in Nazi Germany?
Well, I think some of their lads...
Ernst Röhm comes to mind.
I think some of their lads imagine that they might be. But I think that if you look at what happened in Northern Ireland, you can march like that, but actually fighting is a bit of a different thing. And they're not really, they can make an awful lot of trouble. But win a civil war when they haven't got a single elected councillor in Britain anywhere? I don't think so.
Claude Moraes says he fully supports the Together Against Trump demonstration, coinciding with his visit on the 13th of July, and also the Stand Up to Racism's call for a peaceful protest on the 14th of July against another pro-Robinson demo. Everyone who cares about the future of our society should come together for the politics of unity, not division, he says.
Well, that week is shaping up, because on the Thursday, the 12th, there's going to be an anti-Trump protest in Bristol, which will assemble at the Fountains at 5 p.m. There's then going to be a coach to London the following morning for those who've got time to go on a Friday to protest against Trump. And clearly also, Tommy Robinson and his chums have got to realise, if you demonstrate, we're going to demonstrate against you. That's what we did with the National Front in the 1980s, and that's what we'll do again. And we'll beat them.
Do you see this kind of thing actually having waves with more civil unrest?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, we were discussing earlier the potential collapse of the economy and so on, and in those circumstances, the possibility of far right coming to power, as they've done in the Ukraine and as they may do in other European countries, it's definitely there. And of course, the real danger is that the US is lurching down in this this direction, and they've got the biggest military on the planet. But ultimately, if we're going to have sovereignty, Tommy, it means looking at where the jihadis came from, and they came from MI6, as anybody will tell you who knows anything about it. And I believe that both EDL and Al-Nadja Haroon, the Captain Hook and all the rest of it, MI5 agent, Tommy, MI5. And Tommy's had lots of chats with MI5, I'm sure. And he's being set up to be a martyr, to gather all these people together. And then the police will turn around to the liberal centre like us and say, oh, well, we've got to have more powers to deal with people like Tommy. And we'll go, oh, yes, great. And then they turn around to others and say, we're going to have more powers to deal with the Muslims. Oh, great. But in actual fact, the whole thing is being orchestrated by the intelligence services. It's a strategy of tension, Gladio-style strategy of tension. They've been doing it for years. They're still doing it. It's not, everything is not what it seems.
Peace.
BCFM.
Well, as I said at the top of the hour, we're going to have a look now to the Bilderberg Conference last week. Noticed over in Turin, this is the NATO zone's most powerful business lobby. It's been going ever since 1954. It meets once a year. It was chaired for the first 20 years by a former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who also betrayed the British troops at Arnhem by sending in a so-called agent that betrayed the entire plan to the Abwehr. So there's a sort of in a nutshell what Bilderberg is, but last week we got in slightly rudely interrupted, Martin, by the Italian police, didn't we, because our journalists were being detained as all their identities were checked, even though they knew exactly who they were.
Well, that's right, and it'll be interesting to hear what others have got to say about what happened at Bilderberg last week, which wasn't hardly reported, apart from in the alternative press, wasn't it?
Well, there is a documentary that they've made, which they mention here, which is very well worth a watch, which has got English subtitles. We'll hear now from the We Are Change Rotterdam crew that were over there filming. That's Maria van Maria van Boelkelen and Marco Verhage, mostly Maria, because she's the one who's really interested in this whole high-tech stuff that the Bilderberg are talking about and the 5G.
From my point of view, that is everything that involves AI, 5G, or the development of the smart control grids that we're facing. So they talked about the future of work, which definitely will go on about AI. There was a big research paper done by KPMG, and it was all about the effects of AI on the workforce, and that is stunning, you know, that is big, that is major. So they have to talk about the future of work, obviously.
How do we know if we're talking to a real person or a computer nowadays?
You can't, unfortunately. It will be very difficult to make sure that, on the other hand, like right now, there is a real person. And I think they did, from their perspective, a splendid job. They did the Turing test and they took it to several chatbots. And it was believably difficult, so hardly impossible, to make sure that the person which is talking to you, to make sure that it's a human person.
So what you're saying is somebody who you're talking to in either an internet chat room or maybe on Twitter could just be artificial intelligence computer.
Exactly. It's something that I love to hate, or I hate to love, but still, you can also see there is a new technology. You can talk in your head, I'm not kidding you around, silently talk in your head, and then we are connected with another person that has this specific tool put it on his head. It's now still quite big, but that's only a matter of time. So we're entering an age that we don't know exactly if the person that we're talking to is really a person. And that's possible to have a sort of telepathy between persons, so you don't know if people are speaking with them when you are sitting with them in the room. So you could imagine what that would mean in terms of justice, people that get picked up by the police, etc. So we're really entering a sort of twilight zone.
Sounds to me like science fiction, this. And the other problem with that kind of telepathy system is what happens when you're able to read someone else's thoughts and they don't know.
Exactly. So they're a little bit hush-hush about this kind of possibilities, because they now only are looking at a way that people give their consent. But on the other hand, you know, these developments are going incredible fast. And so what we see that is public is probably out of the pilot phase and pushed in regular usage. So that's one thing that you have to keep in mind. So that's all about artificial intelligence. Then you have, in the same week, you have this quantum computing. Well, quantum computing is a term that I don't think that most Bilderbergers knows a lot about. It's quite difficult to understand. So I'm really in doubt why as well artificial intelligence as quantum computing is on the list. But I have to admit, when you see the lineup, we see Jared Cohen over there, we see Alex Karp, we see Hasabis. These are all people from very powerful companies like DeepMind, like Google.
Palantir?
Yeah, Palantir, thank you.
Yeah, so this, let's have a little chat about these technologies, though, because I've been having a look at Palantir and their various systems. One of them is called Gotham, which I imagine is modelled on Gotham City in Batman. And the idea is that they're trying to sell this technology to our politicians, to our civil servants, and saying, well, using this technology, you can completely understand and look into and drill down into your entire population. So, for example, if you wanted to know where the Muslims are in your country, if you wanted to know where the rich people are, if you wanted to know where the people who use bicycles are, if you wanted to know where the people who shop at a particular supermarket are in your country, you can have a map using this Palantir technology of everybody and where they are, and you can understand. I mean, this is what they're doing, is they're selling this to our politicians, saying here's the best way to understand who your voters and your population are.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think with the rollout of 5G that is going quite smooth and swiftly in Europe, they have set up a sort of control grid, because 5G, probably you know this, needs a very tight network. You know, the frequency makes it possible to have real-time data exchange. And that's not only about pictures, so it's not only about facial recognition, but it's also about sounds. So you can do anything with this. So it's not only about receiving the information, it's also about sending information or frequencies.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it, because we think of these, I mean, we've got a lot of government money behind smart meters here in Britain.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're pushing these things into our houses, even though the people don't want them. The idea is that you can have a smart meter, which you can access. The fact of the matter is, though, that also the electricity, the gas companies, they can access these things and they can switch it off. The other thing is that if it's hacked, somebody from China, America, the NSA, GCHQ, whoever can hack in and switch off your power. So these things are a bit of a cursed technology. They call it the Internet of Things. What do you make of this smart technology?
Oh, yeah. Well, we made a documentary about the subject. It's called Digitropolis. Digitropolis, it's an hour-long documentary about health, about the effects on your daily routine, about how is power developed, and it's not in Dutch.
It's
subtitles in English, in German,
subtitles. Fantastic.
In Spanish. So, but the most important thing about this is that, and that is something I want to underline, is that we don't think about what is happening right now under our nose. So for an example, for the smart meters, you have this activist group called Empower. I think people need to check this out, because they are doing a very great job. But the other thing is that all these little 5G boxes that we'll put on our Latin poles, they will actually have the possibility to create a sort of active denial system. The same system that is used in Iraq by defense. So you can imagine if they can
hang on, turn. This is the lampposts, and you've got boxes on top of the lampposts, and if they're configured in a certain way, it will emit such a concentration of microwaves that it actually starts to burn your skin and you have to run away.
Exactly. I'm not saying that they will do that, but that they will be able to do this. And I think that's scary enough.
Maria, what about your favorite participant?
Well, my favorite participant is definitely Jared Cohen. This guy is really amazing. He's now the head of Jigsaw. And Jigsaw is a part of Google. Before, it was well known as Google Ideas. And this guy is really something different. I think he was 24 years old. He already worked with Condoleezza Rice. Then he worked with Hillary Clinton. He was well known as the person who was twittering when Iran burned. And then he was a special advisory of advisor of Richard Holbrooke. And he wrote a bestseller a book with Eric Schmidt from Google. And he really introduced Gerard Cohen as a sort of, well, how you could say it, our new savior. So this guy is very well known in politics on a very high level. And he is very smart and now head of one of the most powerful tech companies in the world. So, well, that gives you quite an idea why this guy is so incredibly important for now and I think for the next couple of 10 years.
You've got the dreams of the super rich. These are the sorts of people who, you know, their money, they've bought everything they possibly can with the money they've got, the billions of dollars that they're, you know, in control of. They can buy, you know, multiple houses. They can buy themselves their own private jet. They can buy a nice luxury yacht, whatever it is. But once they've got all those things,
they want more. They want more, Tony. Don't you understand? They always want more.
It's never enough.
No.
And that's why I bring up transhumanism, because there are some people out there, I mean, whether they're right or wrong, I have no idea, but they're selling this idea that you can actually go beyond being a human. That is to say...
And they are doing it right now.
What they're saying is, I mean, I think it's Ray Kurzweil, who's the head of engineering at Google, because Google feature very big at this year's Bilderberg. When somebody asked him, they said, do you think God exists? Ray Kurzweil says, well, no, but he will soon.
Oh, yeah. But Ray Kurzweil is a very special person. He's also one of the major figures in our documentary because he's a visionary, you know. I think he's in this business for ages, I think over 30 years. And he has this very strong idea that he wants to make a step up, a new evolution, the humanoids 2.0, as he calls it. And it's not about digital revolution. It's all about a human evolution. And Ray Kurzweil want to be the person that supports this, that makes this possible.
But is this a utopia or is it a dystopia?
No, it's not a utopia. And I think Ray Kurzweil mentioned that 2028 will be the moment that we will be humanoids. And he makes a very strong case about this. And I think it's feasible. And if you look at other related designs like Neuralace and Neuralink, that is now more or less owned by Elon Musk, you have to admit it will be quite simple, a matter of time before we will be able to have our personal experience like you're looking at a movie right now, or you can learn a language in, well, an hour or two. So it's really entering the matrix in a way that we never thought of. We always thought of a fear for chips or something in our body. That's not really the point anymore. We went way beyond this whole concept. And we're looking to a new evolution. That's one of the major topics, I think, that we as journalists are now trying to understand and trying
But Maria, surely, I mean, I'm sure if Ray was here, he'd say, look, this could be a wonderful utopia.
Oh, yeah. Of course, I think, and I have to admit, a lot of developments that comes from and inventions that comes from AI are marvelous, and I love them all. So it's not about what they develop, it's how you use this technique. And I think there is no ethical restrictions, no law, no common sense about that we really need to think about what can happen in the worst case scenario. But everyone is driven by money. Everyone wants to get a piece of the pie and they want to be the first one because there's a lot at stake right now. So, yeah, we are looking at a very interesting time, and I think it will all kick off by the implementing of 5G, because that is the infrastructure that AI needs to really develop more quicker than it does right now.
The singularity which these transhumanists talk about is this whole idea that the computer will actually become conscious. Do you think that's real? That sounds like you know, that 2001, The Space Odyssey.
It will definitely happen. Like Elon Musk say, artificial intelligence will develop itself super speed. And what will happen is that we will not understand. We are not able to understand the output of AI. That's a huge problem. You have to compare us to an AI as a sort of pet, like Elon Musk said. We're a sort of nice cat comparing to what AI will be. So if you don't restrict it, if you don't use it in the correct way, if you don't make sure that all the check and balances are okay, we will look at a very dystopian future. And it's not in 100 or 200 years. It's probably between 50 and 80 years.
Also, genetic engineering is a big part of this. They're saying that they believe that they might be able to genetically engineer humans so that they will, their children anyway, will live forever.
And they're already doing it. If you know the Chinese company BGI, you have to really to check that, that these guys are amazing. They've done a lot of work with CRISPR-Cas9, that is part of your DNA that seems to be really easy to modify. But in China, you already can make sure that your children have a nice eye color or they don't suffer from depression, if that's the point in your family background. So we all are already entering this zone.
And okay, how much do I have to pay in order for my children to live forever then?
Yeah, that's a good thing. How much do you have to pay? I don't have a clue, but I'm sure it will be a figure.
Probably the figure that only the Bilderbergers can afford it.
And especially the Chinese very rich, or the Saudis, or people that have loads of money and power. But I don't think it's only about money. It's also about exchanging powers and exchanging network opportunities.
Yeah. So I wonder what our former Home Secretary Amber Rudd made of all that last weekend at the Bilderberg conference. That was Maria Birkelen and a brief little bit with Marco Verhage from We Are Change Rotterdam, who actually got, if you go onto their YouTube channel, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. You get a lot of the shots of the people actually arriving. They got absolutely brilliant position to shoot from, which nobody else seemed to get. Anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8 now. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and Fee Hance, who's Green Councillor for Redland earlier. Dialects on next Tuesday at noon. You'll find this show's podcast, story, links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. And I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. Don't let the banksters get you down.
On the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.